As I mentioned in the introduction, we have a special interview with a woman who is part of Living Transgender History today. As I mentioned before, Joanna Clark essentially framed the whole issue of transgender persons in the military, but she's known for so much more than that. She's not just a single footnote in history. She was instrumental in the fight for transgender rights across several decades. She was instrumental in the fight against HIV/AIDS, and she has continued her advocacy and her activism even into, I believe she mentioned that she is 80 years old as of right now. We have Joanna Clark on the phone with us from California. Joanna, are you there?
Yes, I am, Joanna.
It's very glad to have you here, and welcome very much to Trans Talk.
Thank you.
I wondered if we could just start with you perhaps giving a little bit of a background about your history, you know, your roots and where you came from before you ended up with such an incredible life.
Well, I'm a Michigander originally. Came from Pontiac, Michigan. And I entered the Navy in 1955 as a reservist. Went active the day after I graduated from high school in 57. And from there, I went to Norman, Oklahoma for school, and then on to Memphis for more schooling, and then finally my first assignment in Bermuda for 3 years, and came back to Memphis for 6 years of instructor duty, and then from there to Hawaii, where I flew with the Patrol Squadron 6 and was an ATOPS instructor evaluator on the P-3 Orion, a 4-engine turboprop. Deployed to Naha during that time and on to Cameron Bay in 68, and came back and left active duty for a job in saturation diving, and that failed after 18 months when the company went bankrupt. And so from there I went to Kwajalein Atoll for 2 years as a project coordinator on the Safeguard Sprint anti-ballistic missile system, and finally reached my point where I just could not continue on in the male role that I'd been forced into. So I came back and went to Stanford University. They had a gender program there, and I notified the Naval Reserve that I was undergoing gender reassignment, and they promptly discharged me.
Wow. At what age? One thing I wanted to ask, are you on a speakerphone right now?
Yes.
Okay. Is it possible? We're getting a little bit of feedback from that. Is it possible you could switch to a other phone? It's okay if you can't, but...
Sure. How's this? Any better?
Yes. Thank you. So
okay.
You made it to the level of Navy Chief Petty Officer during your honorable service, didn't you?
Yes, I did.
Wow, that's incredible. And how early had you fought with this, with your gender identity, with your, you know, your feeling of being transgender throughout your service? Was that even possibly an inspiration for joining?
Entirely. My first feelings were probably about 3 or 4 years old that I was in the wrong gender.
Wow. I know many friends of mine that have been in the Navy or other parts of the armed forces, although it seems to be predominantly the Navy, who said that they joined the service because they, quote, hoped it would make a man out of them, unquote. I don't know if you had a similar type of feeling in some way.
Oh, I had those feelings for a while, then realized that wasn't going to happen. My family had been military during the war, and so they kind of pushed me, you know, you need to go into the service. And so I went into the service, and I thought throughout those years that if I came out to my folks that I would lose my family, which didn't happen, amazingly. But
wow,
back in those days,
lucky.
You know, you were alone. There were no programs here in the U.S. for gender, and anybody was transgendered, they were basically in the closet. And it wasn't until, 52 when the Christine Jorgensen story broke, and it was a large article in Parade magazine,
yes.
Sunday Throwaway.
You would have been...
I saw that and for the first time felt, hey, I'm not alone.
That's what I was going to ask, yes. That you would have been about 14 when the news broke about her.
Mm-hmm.
And doubt, was that really profound for you?
Oh, yes, very much so. In fact, I kept the article for quite a few years. I hid it in underneath my mattress. And one day we're changing the bed, my mother found it, and she just looked at it and then tossed it and didn't say anything.
Oh, geez.
And so, needless to say, I was alone. And after the Navy discharged me, and then, of course, my DDT-14s all showed me as being a male, and trying to find work with no job history that I could actually, you know, report, presented a problem. So I wrote a letter to the Navy and asked them to change, and they said, no way. And so I wrote a letter to my congresswoman in Hawaii, and also one to Philip Hart, who was the head of the Armed Services Committee in the Senate. And Senator Hart came to my rescue and told the Navy they needed to change my records.
Wow.
Which they did.
Yeah, that's awesome.
And so then about a year later, I was working at the County of Orange, and a lieutenant colonel came in and asked if he could put up some recruiting posters for the Army Reserve. And so I walked him down to the bulletin board where he could put them up, and he says, would you be interested? And I says, I'd love to join, but I'm not eligible. And he says, what do you mean you're not eligible? He says, are you older than 32? And I says, yes. He says, did you have any prior service? And I says, yes, 12 years active and 5 years reserve. And he says, well, then you're eligible. And I says, no. I says, sadly, I'm not. And so he pressed me, and he says, why? And I says, oh, what the heck? So I told him. And he just looked at me, and he says, did you see Medical Center last night? And I says, yes, I did watch it. And that was the first time it had, you know, the issue of transsexualism on television. And
I'm going to have
so
to look
anyways,
up that episode.
He asked me then, he says, well, why would that keep you from doing your job? And I says, it shouldn't. And he says, well, send me your DD-214. Let me look into it. So I did. And a month later, he says, if you can pass the physical, we can take you. So I went out, filled out all the paperwork, was very careful not to hide anything in the paperwork, and went over and took the physical and passed it. And on February 6th of 1976, I was sworn in as a sergeant first class.
That's incredible. I mean, you went in openly transgender, not hiding anything, and in 1976, they let you on in. That is groundbreaking. As far as I know from my research, you're the first transgender person to ever have been admitted openly as a transgender person.
As far as we know, yes. And after I'd been with them for about 3 months, they asked me if I would go full time. They had a program which was they called reserve technicians. They were civilians. You could wear your uniform during the day, and you basically ran a reserve battalion. And then on the weekends when the personnel came in to drill, you'd serve with them. And we'd stand behind the commanding officer and say, please don't do that.
Did you have to do that a lot?
So anyways, I was with them for 18 months, and then my supervisor was in an accident, and that put me in command of the civilian unit. And but I needed to be a warrant officer to hold the position. So they nominated me for warrant officer, and that's when all the problems started. The application got to Washington, and the next thing I knew, I was being investigated. And but really strange thing was that they sent me over for a physical exam at the Naval Hospital, and the doctor that was examining me, Dr. Jose Smith, was a Navy captain, and he stopped in the middle of the pelvic exam and says, this is too important. He says, I want you to come back tomorrow. And I says, okay, why? He says, I want you to see the head of every department. There'll be board-certified Navy captains.
Mm-hmm.
And so I came back. I spent 2 hours with a psychiatrist, went to internal medicine, finally to OBGYN, and I was told not to tell them unless they asked.
That sounds good.
And so I'm there on the table, and he's doing a pelvic exam on me, and he says, I don't understand why they asked me to do this. Any junior officer could have done it. And he says, why would they ask me to do it for you? And I says, well, I'm special. And he says, what do you mean? I says, I've been through gender reassignment. And he popped his head down, looked around again, and looked up at the nurses. Now I can say I've seen everything. But he says, I still don't understand. There's nothing wrong with you, is there? And I says, I have no complaints. So he says, okay. And so the next day I came back, and they took me into the commanding officer's office, and all the doctors were there. And they said, this is the way we have to write it up. Disqualified on the basis of current AR-40-501, paragraph 13F. Qualified physically and psychologically in all aspects to fulfill the duties of her rank and position. And the next day, the Army voided my enlistment.
And that section they disqualified you under, that was a specific policy?
Yes, there was a specific paragraph in there that prevented the induction, appointment, or enlistment of anyone who had been through sex reassignment. Now, what was really interesting is that was Chapter 2 that dealt with enlistment, appointment, and Chapter 3 dealt with people that were in the service more than 4 months.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't mentioned there as a pre-existing condition. So they technically had no grounds to void my enlistment or discharge me.
I see. So that was one of the things that you could use when you fought the military.
Yes, yes. So I fought, and I went to court, and finally won a small settlement from them, and an honorable discharge, but I wasn't allowed back in. I had about 3.5-4 months to go to retire.
Oh, that's a shame.
So, but I didn't start out to be an activist, and then one day I was attending college and working on becoming a social worker, and one of the speakers that came to the class was Jude Patton, a female to male, and we became friends, and one night he asked me if I would go with him up to Los Angeles. They were having a meeting there at the Melrose Wilcox Mental Health Center. And I said, sure, I'd like to go along. And I hadn't met. Jude was the first transgender person I met at the time. And as I say, because everybody at that time was in the closet. And we went up there, and there was about 15 transgendered there. And this doctor, Dr. Brown, who was a butcher, and we finally got him disqualified, and he finally went to jail, and then I think he died there. Because he was doing surgeries on his kitchen table.
Wow.
Since the hospital wouldn't allow it. But anyways, these 15 people were there, and they were all complaining when they couldn't change their birth certificate and couldn't get a job because of that. And I asked, well, why can't you change it? And he says, well, it's because of the law. And I kind of made a flippant remark, and I says, well, change the law.
That's so.
And I wasn't asked to come back.
And that's so very compelling as an intro to the next part of your life. We're going to have to take a short...
On the way home, I was talking to Jude, and I said, you know, I'm not even registered to vote. I've only voted once, and that was for John Kennedy. And I always used the excuse that I was never in one area long enough to get familiar with the local politics. And so I says, I think I got to try and see what can be done. And it wouldn't affect me because I wasn't born in California. But I got home that night, and I told my mother and dad the next morning what I was going to do. And my dad had been a city councilman, and he says, you're out of your mind. Nobody's going to listen to you.
Well,
and I says, well, I got to try. So I went into work, and we had word processors there, and I got there early, wrote my letter, put it in the word processor, and ran off 120 letters for every member of the legislature and mailed them off that night.
Joanna, Joanna, we're going to have to take a short break for some station announcements and come back in about a minute to talk more with you. Please stay on the line. We really want to hear the rest of your story, okay?
Okay, we'll do.
Thank you.
What's that sound, you ask? It's the sound of one-time-use trash. People get bottled water because of hydration, convenience, and the claim of better taste and quality. Truth is, there's usually no difference between bottled and tap water. The healthier choice is to get a cool, reusable bottle made of lined aluminum, steel, glass, or special plastic that won't break off chemical bits like the plastic used in disposable bottles. Get healthy and keep your world from becoming a big junk pile. Disposables dead. Brought to you by J.C. Herman High School and 90.1 FM KKFI.
The KC Clay Guild Holiday Pottery Sale and Studio Tour, Friday, December 1st through Sunday, December 3rd, where you will find a wide array of local handmade pottery from dozens of artists across KC. KC Clay Guild is a proud supporter of KKFI. Located at 200 West 74th Street in Kansas City, Missouri, the KC Clay Guild Holiday Pottery Sale and Studio Tour. For more information, including adult and children's classes and gift certificates, kcclayguild.org.
You're back with us on Trans Talk, this week's episode of The Tenth Voice, that is. And we're talking to Joanna Clark, who is just about to tell us how she got really going with being an activist in California. Joanna?
Okay. Well, as I said before the commercial break, on the way home, I decided I had to see if the Constitution that I've been defending really worked. And so with the letters I sent off, I got 10 responses. Thank you for your inquiry, but no. And then I got a call from an attorney in San Francisco. And he says, I heard about your letter writing campaign, and I've been trying to get a driver's license here for one of my clients who's transgendered. And he says, I'd like to help you if I can. Let me go and talk to my assemblyman, who was... that time the Speaker of the Assembly. And a couple weeks later, I get a phone call and says, my congressman or assemblyman is willing to carry the bill. And I says, great. So Jude and I, we went up and we addressed the committee. And they were going to vote it down. And then one of the speakers there was from the Concord office where they registered birth certificates. And he says, we have a problem. We have a child who's being forced to dress as a girl in school because his birth certificate says he's a female. I says, it's a typographical error. And we can't change it. So the assembly went ahead and they passed it and sent it down to the Senate. In the Senate, it was going down. And all of a sudden, Dennis Carpenter, who was Mr. Ultra Conservative from Orange County, pushed his button in to speak, and he got up and he says, I really don't understand all the aspects of this. I know it's a medical situation, and I think it's the right thing to do. And he voted yes. And a whole bunch of voters that had already cast their vote changed him, and it passed by 5 votes.
That's incredible. A conservative
and Governor
Republican.
Governor Brown signed it into law, AB 385. So that was my beginning. And I worked with Jude, and others then started to come out of the closet and get involved. So it wasn't all my doing. But they helped write letters and what have you. And the next thing we did is people were going overseas to get their surgery, and they couldn't get their passports changed. And so we worked with the passport office, and they finally said, well, we'll issue a temporary passport good for a year so that they can go over. And so that was another problem that we got solved. And Social Security, they didn't want to change the name on the records, and we had to fight that. And as I say, I didn't do it alone. I had help. But the help back then was nothing like today, where you have large organizations around the country.
And one part of it was the aspect of getting information out. Here you can go into Google and type transgender or I'm a girl that feels like a boy or something and get 10 million hits. But back then, everything was in just by print media, what you could find in the libraries, what you could find by directly talking to people. But that sort of leads us in to a very major part of your career as an activist, which was Aegis and how that got started. Would you like? I understand that even has kind of a local Missouri connection to the start of it.
Yes, it does. In 88, I made vows as a sister, and I was open about it with the church, and the press got a hold of it because of my having been in the press with the Army issue. And they showed up and reported on it. The next day, the diocese, they kind of went into cardiac arrest. And they decided, no, you should have talked to us first. And I says, I did. I even told you we should try and postpone this until the press lost interest.
And my understanding, you were an Episcopal nun?
No, you said if the press shows up, it's because God wants them there, so don't worry about it.
And my understanding is you were originally an Episcopal nun?
Yes. Yes. And so, anyways, they kind of gave me the cold shoulder then, and I said, well, I made my vows to God, not to the church, so to speak. And so I continued on doing my activism to a certain degree. And I got involved in HIV and AIDS, and then I went to a conference in Kansas City, and there was a young woman there who said, I'd like to get involved with your community. And I says, she told me, she says, you know, I know you're having a hard time in California, so why don't you come here to Missouri, and we can work together on my farm and go from there. We can herd the cows that I have, and we can market them to homeless shelters and what have you.
How did you go from herding cows to creating a giant bulletin board system that helps people with AIDS?
Well, one day I was going into the Walmart in Versailles, and a young man came out, and he didn't look all that well, and he had a Kaposi sarcoma lesion. And it was visible, and I knew what it was, and I walked over and introduced myself. And the poor fellow was just so scared when I told him I knew what it was. He says, oh, my God. He says, did anybody else know? And I says, I doubt it. I says, I'm here from California, and I've been working with people that are HIV positive, so I was familiar with it. And then I realized that these people, they had nobody to talk to. Stover, where I was at, had a population of 1,400. The doctor came every Wednesday for 4 hours. He was a circuit rider. And they couldn't go to him, and they couldn't use their telephone lines because everybody had a party line. And in those days, they were burning houses down just to get you out of the neighborhood. And so I had an interest in, of course, electronics from my training and all that, and I started playing with electronic bulletin board just before I came to Stover, and I said, hey, here's the way to do it. We can put it all online, and they can get it from a bulletin board. And so I went back to California and set up the bulletin board, and I would say within 6 months, we were in about 100 countries. Using what was called FidoNet. And this is a system where a bulletin board would call up after 11 o'clock at night, download all your information, upload anything they had for you at that time, and they would pass it around. And that's the way it passed from one bulletin board to another. And a bulletin board network in the Netherlands, HIVNet, they contacted me and got involved, and then a bulletin board in South Sydney Hospital got involved, and it just began to expand. And the next thing I knew, I was in a fight with the National Library of Medicine. At that time, they had what they called Grateful Med, and you had to pay for it. So I was buying their AIDS line data and their AIDS drugs and AIDS trials information, putting it on the bulletin board, and the next thing I knew, all my lines were tied up with government agencies. So I called to find out what's going on, and I says, well, it's Reagan. They have to pay interagency fees whenever they get data from the National Library of Medicine or other agencies. And I says, well, that's crazy. And I says, the people that need the information can't get it because they're tying up my system because I'm giving it away for free. And so one of them says, well, here, I'm going to give you a fax number. You write a letter to Vice President Gore and then fax it off to him. So I faxed a letter on a Thursday at about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, which would have been 7 in Washington. And the next morning I got a call from Vice President Gore's office, and we received your fax. The Vice President has read it, and he will take care of it.
Is that how he invented the Internet?
By Tuesday, there was no government agency contacting the bulletin board. But then the National Library of Medicine called me up and gave me a non-billable access code.
Wow.
And so that I could get the information for free. But then they realized they had just created a nightmare for themselves because they were Democrats. And if the Republicans found out that they were giving me the information for free to distribute, they were going to have a political problem. And so they got the idea then the Internet was coming along, and they would take Grateful Med and put it on as PubMed and make it available to the world for free.
Wow,
and
so
that solved their problem.
That's how that started.
Yeah, I've used that many times.
I know, me too.
So anyways, then I got a call from, can't think of their name right now, Senior Moment. They were a public relations firm in New York, and they worked with Roxanne Laboratories, and they wanted to know if I would accept any funds to go on the Internet. And I said, well, under certain conditions, I would. And I told them my conditions were that if they had a drug that wasn't any good, I wasn't going to promote it. And they said, I'm pretty sure they can live with that. Can I have them contact you? And 20 minutes later, I get a call from Tom Sawyer. And I immediately thought, Tom Sawyer? Although this has got to be kidding. But he says, we'd like to come out and talk to you. And would you be available tomorrow morning? And I says, yes. And I says, where are you coming from? He says, Columbus, Ohio. And I says, we'll get into the Orange County Airport about 9 o'clock, and we should be at your place by 10. And I says, okay. So 10 o'clock the next morning, they were on my front porch. And they said, let's go to lunch. We went to lunch, and we talked about it, getting on the Internet and what it would cost. And I says, well, for the first year, it's going to cost you $109,000. At that time, a T1 was $2,000 a month, and 32 megabytes of memory was going to be about $2,500 also. And so I had to build a server. But with that, we got on the Internet. The National Library of Medicine called and says, we'd like to help too, and we'll give you $25,000 a year. And then I called them back after 2 years, and I says, I can't do this anymore alone. I need some help. And they said, how many do you need to hire? And I says, at least two for starters. And they says, fine, we'll have a check to you tomorrow. And that was the beginning of it. We had a staff of six eventually, and we worked out of my home here. And then finally we got the park where we live. I'm in a mobile home park, started complaining about my running a business out of the house. So we moved downtown and got an office there, and we were there for about a year, and then we lost some of our funding. And so we moved everything back to the house, but this time we had a wide area network, and everybody worked from home. And one of our staff moved to New York and was there during Hurricane Sandy and lost all her power. And so she would drive inland to a McDonald's that had Wi-Fi. And she would get there at 8 o'clock in the morning, have breakfast, and sit there at a table and do her work all day long using the McDonald's Wi-Fi. And then she'd go home in the evening and say, well, I got my day's work done.
So what is the current status of the system that you helped create?
Well, at our peak, we were serving 18 million people a year worldwide. The furthest we got to is we had McCurdo Sound was logging into us on a regular basis. And the White House would log in every morning. But as the funding was lost, we finally reached a point where we had to operate on reserve funds. And so in May of 2015, we finally had to shut her down. And I've taken and given the database to a group in England, one to the was shared with the University of California at San Francisco, and one went to the National Library of Medicine. So bits and pieces that are still online. But I think for me it was the hardest thing in my life to do, because our motto had always been, until there's a cure, there's Aegis. But we weren't able to continue it. I would have liked to, but with the cost of a T1, it dropped to $700 a month. But my electric bill was running over $700 a month.
Absolutely. It can be really challenging to get funding for efforts like this, even nowadays.
And we never asked for more than $3 a year donation from our users. We figured if they gave $3 a year, if they could afford that, we would have had more than enough funds to operate.
Now, you've received quite a lot of recognition for your work. And, you know, reading out for the audience that's listening out there, Joanna is the recipient of the Award of Courage from the American Foundation for AIDS Research, the Jonathan Mann Award for Health and Human Rights from the International Association of Physicians in AIDS Care, the Crystal Heart Award from the San Diego GLBT Center, and the Joan of Arc Award from the Orange County Community Foundation. And I know that in 2005, along with people such as Pope John Paul II and Václav Havel, the president of the Czech Republic, you were nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's what I'm told.
They didn't give you any sort of like official, you know, gold leaf stationery for your nomination?
No, I found out about it at an HIV summit conference that was put on by GSK, and one of the presenters, one of the doctors there, said, by the way, we have a celebrity in the audience today, Sister Mary Elizabeth, who's just been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. And that was the first time I heard about it. And I'll have to live until 2055 to find out if I was actually nominated, because the Nobel organization does not release the names of nominees until 50 years.
Ah, well, that's plan your investment strategy accordingly.
All I know is what was said that day at the meeting, and what got passed around, I guess, over the years.
So let me ask you, what are you're now? I believe you're 79 or 80 years old and still going
79
strong.
Now.
What is your current involvement with the community, with the transgender community?
Well, when I got involved in HIV and AIDS, I kind of lost contact with the transgender community, and even though I've gotten involved in a few things, writing letters for people in support of what they were doing. I stayed pretty much with the AIDS community until May, and then when that shut down, I went ahead and got involved in environmentalism.
So what sort of work have you been doing in that area?
Mainly making the President of the United States uncomfortable.
That's a worthy goal.
I have a fax line here. And I have all of Congress on speed dial. And I've learned that if I write a letter to any senator or congressman that doesn't represent me, they look at the zip code and they just fire it over to my representative in their local guard mail, as they call it. So what I do is I write a letter to the president, put a large FYI on the top of it, and then fax that to all the congressmen. And I have found that they actually then read them.
When they get flooded by so many forwards, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and one congressman called me, and he says, I want to thank you for keeping us in the loop. Like, it's nice to know what people are writing to the president. And he says, well, you're quite welcome. Just get involved with climate change. We've got to do something about it.
Yes, we can't just build seawalls for Trump's golf courses when the whole of the rest of the country will be flooded and he'll have to travel there by one of his fabulous boats.
Yeah. Well, let's face it, Mar-a-Lago, his favorite, is going to be flooded pretty soon.
Well, I don't know if I can say we can only hope, but...
it seems unfair on the rest of that community, though.
Yeah, that would be the unfair thing.
I mean, it's pretty bad. It's like the Norfolk Naval Base is being flooded on a regular basis now at high tide. So you see cars in the parking lot and seawater up to halfway up their door.
People probably don't think of that, because when they think of naval bases, they think of the ships, but they don't think of the fact that they need the land to be based from and for the people to live on to staff them.
Absolutely. I was just down at Pensacola at the naval base there where the Blue Angels are headquartered, and it was just alarmingly close to the water down there.
Yes. And high tide, they're probably getting some water coming into their parking lots.
And hopefully not the runway strips.
Yeah, hopefully not them. But if you go down, I know, to Miami and that during high tide, and you'll see fish swimming in the streets.
But that gives a whole new flavor to the community down there.
Yes, it does.
There's one thing I wanted to ask you here. I wanted to make sure we got in before we close out the interview with you, which has been absolutely fascinating to hear. The issue of transgender troops in the military has been one of the, you know, it's been one of the most prominent issues with our community over the last year, especially with the, you know, Trump's reversal of the Obama era directives and so forth. Do you have some advice or words of wisdom or words of inspiration that you would give to present and former members of the military services that are transgender?
Well, I'd say don't give up. I think in the end that the military is going to continue to be allowed to take transgendered people into the service now. It only took 41 years, but this has started. They've got, 1,500, I think, now that have come out of the closet that are serving. And it's just too costly to replace them.
I know they're having enlistment problems and some issues and trying to step up recruitment, and at the same time they're trying to throw out people that are already trained and have all the skills and abilities they need.
So I wrote letters to the Secretary of Defense and the previous Secretary of Defense, and included pictures of before and after. And neither responded to me, but Diane Saunders, a paralegal friend of mine, we worked together on a number of cases when we were with ACLU, and we've prepared amicus briefs, but so far none of the people that are suing in the Jane Doe cases and that have requested that our cases be put together and submitted.
Do you think that this will go all the way to the Supreme Court?
I think it's possible. I personally hope it doesn't, because of the fact that we've now got a very conservative Supreme Court there. But on the other hand, it was a conservative court when they made same-sex marriage legal. So there is hope.
Yes, and you could never entirely tell how some people will come down on issues, even when you would expect, given their general leanings, that they would go the other way.
Like Roberts has come out twice voting to keep parts of the Affordable Care Act, which has surprised and angered a lot of conservatives, I know.
Uh-huh. So it's hard to say what will happen, but I would say just don't give up.
One question that I had from someone that asked, wanted to make sure to ask you this. At the time you came out, were you aware of other transgender persons in the military who were in stealth?
No. I'll take it back. I was aware of one or two that had served. They hadn't changed gender while in the service or re-enlisted afterwards. But I got wind of it through Senator Hart's office that the Navy had already changed four DD-214s.
Oh, really?
It had been requested. So at least four people that had served had requested them, and they had not been changed, at least as far as they knew. But
and you were
whether
the first
they're changing
to get it changed.
Them now or not, I don't know.
Hopefully yours being changed meant that theirs got unlocked and got changed, too.
Yeah.
I know that currently they don't have much problem changing it, although not much problem is a relative thing.
And treatment at VA centers seems to be mixed, unfortunately.
Yeah. I don't use the VA. I went a couple times to the VA for my injuries from Vietnam, and when I went in to see the doctor just said, back problem. I says, yes, and he reached over his shoulder without even looking at me and handed me a prescription for painkiller. And I says, no, thank you. And so when I reached Social Security age in that, I joined the Kaiser Permanente HMO, and I've gotten excellent care from them. So
I hope that they will keep treating you with care and respect as you enjoy retirement. Joanna, it has been really fantastic hearing your narrative of your history and your place in all of our community's history here, and how great of a contribution that you made fighting from the very beginning. We'd like to thank you so much for coming on to the 10th Voice with us today.
Thank you. But just remember this, I didn't do it alone.
I don't
think
any
of us
does.
Small, there was always people there that came out of the closet and says, let me help.
And that's really important for all of our listeners to remember.
Yes.
Absolutely.
And one other thing I would say, because going back, is that Chris Jorgensen mentioned it to me one day. She says, we take 3 steps forward, we take a step back.
That is really good. That is a really good message to close on. Words from Christine Jorgensen. Joanna Clark, thank you very much for joining us today on Trans Talk.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Thank you.